I'm Paula Gordon. Bill Russell and I are with Hot Gin. As we went away, Bill was saying, doesn't all of this change make people cynical? Well, in addition to that, I had the sense that the basic underlying people were still going back to Confucius, that they were still going back to the old ways.
Yes.
In trying to just make it through the day.
Yes, I think Confucianism is in fact, it's not exactly a religion, but it has penetrated every part of the Chinese life, and people cannot avoid that. That's really a major ethical force.
And that didn't go away with Chairman Mao and the revolution.
No, Chairman Mao very often directly quoted from Confucius. So no, it's impossible. It's a part of the language. And also,
you mean literally?
Yeah, literally. A lot of his phrases, his words, have become a part of the language. You cannot get rid of them. And also, people's mind through generations have been shaped by that influence. I don't mean Confucianism is absolutely positive. It has a lot of dark parts, dark shadows in it. But it is a part of maybe at the core of the Chinese culture.
Well, you made me think of that as you were talking about the cynicism and about money, mm-hmm. because many of the things that you describe in the new China and in the course of the 30 years that you describe in your mm-hmm. fiction seem to have those same threads through certainly 2,000, but maybe 7,000 years. Do you have a sense of that continuity too?
Yes, especially in the book Under the Red Flag. Mm-hmm. You know, all the stories are set in the countryside, so the fabric of life is very ancient, very primitive almost,
And don't change much from one millennium to the next.
No, I think basically they remained the same, very similar to the old days. Yes.
Well, in many ways, I would assume that the significant change occurred when the Red Army won, and after that period, just shortly after the Second World War, that was one of the major displacements in Chinese mm-hmm. history, that mm-hmm. that what had been a principally agrarian culture mm-hmm. adapted an ideology that was essentially a proletariat, a working class, a manufacturing oriented mm-hmm. perspective.
Different of course, from the farmers, the workers were yeah. not.
Of course, adapted to, mm-hmm. to Chinese history and Chinese perceptions, but it would seem that starting then. The wheels started turning in a different way mm-hmm. in China.
Is that right?
Yeah, to some extent, yes, I think it is right. And also, China is a huge country. They started the industrialization, made huge effort to do that. In the moment, so-called the Great Leap, but they didn't make the leap at all.
But it was actually, a good line.
Actually, it was a great jump.
The great attempt at a jump.
Yeah. And so as a result, I would say the majority of the countryside remained the same, and people still work in the fields in the same way. You use buffaloes and shovels and picks. Same.
Intensely hand labor.
I was in the countryside when I was growing up, and we work in the fields. You were the same tools, thousands of years old.
And you're not exaggerating.
No, those are the same. But there are some changes. There are some changes. For instance, the land now belongs to the state. Nobody can own any land. So all the landlords, the capitalists, they were eliminated.
Eliminated quite...
As a class, yes, as a class. But still people, there are rich people and poor people in a town. You know, different kind of rich people, for instance, in one of my story called The Richest Man, the guy was an officer and he saved a lot of money, so he became the richest man.
So, and that still mattered.
Yeah,
And this hierarchy for all that the rhetoric had taken it away, mm-hmm. it sort of just kind of changed names, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, power, you know, power, the people in power now become a kind of higher class, and, because with the power you can have wealth and other benefits. So the distinction, class distinction, is still obvious, but in different form.
You mentioned earlier China's size, yeah. and not only the physical, geographical size, but the number of people there. And there's a tendency for those of us who live on the other side of the world and want to form stereotypes and make things simple to assume that China's China, and all Chinese are alike. And yet the tremendous discrepancies between North and South, and even greater discrepancies between East and West,
and the city and the country.
In the West, in fact, a lot of Caucasians, and white living in the West, Muslims.
Yeah.
It's very different from people in the South.
Holding that together has been a test for, again, 3,000 or 4,000 years.
I know, it's crazy to imagine, the central power to hold those people together.
Well, and it sounds like we're talking about China and not talking about your literature.
Oh, but your literature is China.
Exactly, and what I found striking about it is without a trace of didactic,
none.
That you are able to represent life, I think, as people live it, as individuals live it, not as the people we read about in newspapers and magazines, but as individual people just struggle to get through the day with, with the happiness that goes with it, the sadness that goes, and all the basic challenges.
Yes, and in fact, that was intended, and I think that's the difference between literature and history. History, we have figures, we have ideas, statements, and plans. But when we talk about literature, it is about the individuals, how individuals struggle through a day, how individuals' emotions, ideas, minds function in the environment.
That's interesting in this context because, in fact, you have one of your characters, one of your stories, parts of it deal with the issues around the individual as opposed to the group, the selfishness as opposed to selfhood, which I thought was an interesting distinction.
Oh, yes, professor, yes.
And it would seem that that would be a challenge in the Chinese culture as the Western influence becomes greater, as the Communist Party itself has changed to recognize the importance of wealth or of wealth creation, that struggle between a sense of classlessness and what is good for the group is what is important, juxtaposed to particularly the relatively radical individualism of Western Europe and the United States. But I would think there's an increasing tension in China.
Yes, I haven't returned to China since I came. I guess
in 1985.
I think maybe the tension must have been intensified. In the Chinese language, the word individualism used to be a very negative word.
Negative.
Yes. It's not.
Insult somebody, you call them an individualist.
Yes.
Not a nice thing to say.
Is that historically the case, or is that
historically?
So this is not. This is not new to.
No, it's not new. Not new, and so the collective or the tribe, the community, should be the first. Individuality should be manifested only in the service of the group. That's conventionally, that was the idea, basic idea. Nowadays, I think perhaps because of the Western influence, especially once the Western thought, and younger people might have been more open to individualism, but I don't know to what extent that is accepted. I'm positive that the party doesn't like it.
The appearance from the outside is that the party is ambivalent. They like some of the results of what happens when individuals seek their own, self-aggrandizement.
Yeah.
But that at the same time, it represents a threat to the unity of the country and of the party.
Yeah, I think as long as the individual energy can be contained or channeled to the larger plan, I think that's fine. But if it's too much for the state to control it, and then the individual would be in trouble.
Ha Jin is our guest here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are honored to have you here.
Thank you.
We will all be back shortly. Please stay tuned when we return with the Paula Gordon Show.